get it off, let it off, shut it off, get it off, let it off, shut it off, get it off, let it off, shut it off, get it off, let it off.
Ooh-wee, it's me. Ooh-wee, it's me. Ooh-wee, it's me. Ooh-wee, it's me. I ain't doing nothing but talking shit, so y'all gotta, like, you know, encourage me the whole way along. Ow.
The whole way long. Say, ow, what's poppin', y'all? Konnichiwa. ¿Cómo está mi gente? Yeah, you're listening to the incomparable, notorious public radio.
This is Michael Chiklis, and you're listening to Notorious Public Radio.
Damn right you are. My name is Nestor Rodriguez. I'm your host, also known as
Nestorius, the glorious, the man of the hour, the man of power, the one you need to see. Check your tape, your floppy disk, or your CD.
The wiggy wee, the OPP, the 1, 2, 3. You know what I'm saying? The you wish you was me. The yeah. You ain't here, so take a pee.
The you can't, you don't, you won't stop.
Say
better
what?
Call the cops to get us off your block.
Right off the bat, that's my man Simon Kaufman.
Yes, sir.
And to my left, we got my main Negrozoid, Richard Corbin.
Hello, everybody.
That's right. That's right. And today we have back for the second time the amazing, prolific, scientific,
ilbonic,
bubonic, don't stop the hypersonic, Rosemary Rodriguez, Director Rosemary Rodriguez. What's up, baby?
Yo, what's up?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Hey, yo, right off the bat, if you want, you go to livestream.com, livestream.com, or you can check out the show. But, you know, better yet, go to skidrowstudios.com. There's a little link up there. You can hit live stream, and you can check us out live, man. Video,
Live and direct.
Wrecked. Wrecked. That's right. And if you're at home and you happen to do your underwear and your dry cleaning and you went out and did your groceries and you paid all your bills, you can call 1-800-893-9562 because we're live and we'll be taking calls and all sorts of shit. We have a fun show today. We had Rosemary Rodriguez, who also happens to be my better half, and I mean that sincerely. I just banged into the
and I can vouch for that.
I just banged into the fucking the spring of the microphone. That shit sounded dope. Anyway, we're just gonna go off. But no, seriously, we're gonna keep the AD Dophilus, you know what I'm saying, from Metropolis on the show.
Support for NPR is brought to you by the makers of Ritalin, providing drugs for your children at an early age.
That's right. That's right. So as I was saying, my better half, Rosemary Rodriguez, and she's an amazing director. We're going to talk about female directors. We're going to talk about directing, and we're going to talk about the early history of women in film in Hollywood, because there's a lot of interesting tidbits. And also, we're going to talk about Rosemary's current project, of which I am the executive producer, one of a bunch of producers that are helping get this project off the ground, Silver Skies, which is a film about an over 55 apartment complex that's being taken over, or rather sold for condominiums, and these people are going to get displaced. And it's kind of like a story about that, but it's also a story of the characters. Once you get to a certain age, how no one gives a shit, what do you do with your life, blah, blah, blah. You know, most of us old fucks out there, we don't think about this shit, but we're all getting there. And, you know, there comes a point in our life where, you know, what you going to do, Rich? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like you got to think about it, right? What you gonna do? Anyway, this movie gives you a little insight as to that and makes you laugh and all that stuff. Tell us a little bit about that, real quick, about your movie, Rosemary.
All right. Well, thanks for giving me the opportunity to promote our movie. Little self promotion going on.
Big the fuck up to all that motherfucker that want free promotion on the NPR show.
We've been working on this for a long time. This script was written with the help of my sister, Pat Delaney.
Pat Delaney. Big up, Pat Delaney!
We started writing it, and then on my third episode of directing television, I met Dennis Farina. And it was
the late Dennis Farina.
And it was a really, really hard job.
Mm-hmm. Law and Order.
Yeah, I wasn't gonna name it.
No, what I'm gonna hell? Name. I'm gonna name. It was the original, the original Law and Order.
The mothership. No, it was
the mothership. Right.
I call it the mothership.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. The mothership.
I'd call it mother something.
The
else.
Mothership. It's like. That's the mothership.
Dun 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 dun
dun dun dun dun dun dun dun dun dun dun dun dun dun dun. All right, good. That was horrible.
So I met Dennis. Dennis believed in me at a time when I was questioning whether I should even be a director, because I was getting beat up so badly.
Okay, can I interject? Because I know all about.
Yeah.
I know all about that.
Interject?
Well, I know all about that shit. She's being very kind because she doesn't want to harm certain innocent people or whatever. But
that's what we do.
Right.
We harm the innocent.
That's why I come in. What basically happened was there was a showrunner there who was a douchebag, and he gave my wife a hard time because she's a woman, and of course, she's a woman director, so she doesn't know what the fuck she's doing, right? So we need to just jump in her face and tell her what to do with stank breath and you know, how to do it. We know how to do it, and we can show you how to do it. And so basically, Rosemary would come home really upset and beat down as if her fucking job isn't hard enough, blah, blah, blah. And Dennis Farina was kind of like...
Dennis Farina, after my third day of shooting, I went in the morning and he was there and he said to me, I called everybody, I told them they got to have you back, you're great, whatever. And he became my friend, of course, at that point. So we stayed friendly for years. I showed him the script at some point. He believed in it. He tried to introduce me to a lot of people, helped me try to get money, and we just stayed in touch for years. And then I picked a start date in July, early July of when we would start shooting.
And of 2013, this year.
Yeah, I picked the start date of September 9th with him based on his availability, and July 22nd he passed away. So now the film is dedicated to him.
That's
also
great.
Stars Jack McGee.
Jack McGee, who was on our show a couple times.
Jack McGee from Rescue Me.
From Africa. From Africa.
Yeah. Africa.
And George Hamilton.
Fucking A. We got George Hamilton. Big the fuck up, George Hamilton.
George, I'm going to meet him tomorrow. I'm really excited.
We must be related because my peoples come from Hamilton.
Later on in the show or something, you got to play that Jack McGee plug from
the
Safari.
I will from the Safari. Yeah.
I saw Jack McGee playing racquetball at, what's that, LA Fitness? Is that what it's called?
Yeah. He's up there.
Yeah, I went to go check it out.
On Coldwater.
I got a little password there. There's Jack McGee.
On Coldwater.
On Sepulveda.
Yeah. Oh, you're talking about the one that Rich goes to.
Yeah,
Sepulveda and Victory, across the street from Costco.
Yeah, there he was playing racquetball.
Could you imagine that shit? Leprechaun motherfucker playing racquetball. You know what I'm saying? Big up Jack McGee, you racquetball playing motherfucker.
There's a little mini story with that because Trish started playing racquetball. Trish plays racquetball.
Yeah,
she's really good.
Yeah.
She's really good. I used to play with her.
Don't you have to be a senior citizen and a stockbroker at some point to like play
No, because I was playing. I was pretty good. I busted my head open
really?
A few times on the wall, diving for the ball and stuff. I was really aggressive. But anyways, about Trish. So she was playing with the group, but Jack, she played like once or twice before Jack showed up to play. And they're like, oh, wow, she's really good. Like, all right, when Jack comes, you know, Jack's coming next Wednesday. So when he comes, you got to like play, you know, play like really like, I'm a girl. Like, yeah, I don't know how to play. You know, play with your left hand.
Get to the point. She beat the shit out of him.
No, well, you know, so she
said
he told me.
They set him up.
It's a story, so you got to tell it.
You racquetball hustle Jack McGee.
All right,
you want the Cliff's Notes?
No, but
he doesn't like stories that go in a straight line.
Yeah, this show, no, but the thing is, this show's not about racquetball and bitches beating
listen,
fucking horny
Jack
fucking
McGee
Irish
got
guys.
He got really pissed because Trish played like kind of low, you know, the first couple of up to about 8 points, and then she turned it on and just killed.
So you pool shark Jack McGee in racquetball?
Well, she did.
That's right.
She did. It was hilarious.
I'm trying to find that really fucking upset. Jack McGee clip of him going, Nesta! This is me in Africa. Anyway, I'll find that later. Anyway, continue, Rosemary.
Okay, so George Hamilton plays a character who goes in and out of thinking that he's Dean Martin. He has Alzheimer's.
He's playing Phil,
right. Who is roommates with Jack McGee's character, Nick.
Nick, right.
Who's named after my father. And then we have Valerie Perrine, who's playing Ethel.
Valerie Perrine she was in Superman.
And she was...
the wife
played
of...
Played Honey, opposite Dustin Hoffman and Lenny Bruce.
And Lenny. And also she played W.C. Fields' wife, which we just saw the biopic, which is interesting. So go ahead, who else do we have?
Who else do we have?
Mr. Rodriguez at Craft Services Extraordinaire.
Yeah.
Well, we're still casting.
Well, let's run down.
We have some great producers working with us, like Fred Roos, who's producer of the Godfather movies.
Fred Roos.
And we have Arthur Sarkisian, who's producer of the Rush Hour movies.
Big up, Arta! You crazy motherfucker! Big up, Fred Roos! I call Fred Roos Fred the Rooster. He doesn't know that, but now you do. You know what I mean? But Fred Roos is old school, man. Francis Ford Coppola's homeboy.
Yeah.
And Arthur Sarkisian.
And we have D Street Films.
We got Rico and
Demetrius. Yep. And we got a lot of good people helping us out.
We got Trish Gilfone on the motherfucking product placement, knocking shit out the park. She came in today to the production office with boxes of shit. Like crazy boxes. Anyway, I'm telling you, she's something else. Anyway, so do we have anybody else?
Not right now.
Okay, but in the past week, mm-hmm. you've had face-to-face meetings with Jacqueline Bisset at her home, right?
Yeah.
So basically, you started out trying to get, obviously, since you had Dennis Farina attached, you were trying to get as many old-school Hollywood A-list, you know, ABC
list. A lot of the characters were shooting out in L.A. We're shooting in Sherman Oaks. And so some of the characters, one of them, you know, was a guard at a studio.
Right.
You know, Ethel played a character whose background, who never quite made it.
Okay.
She ended up waiting tables.
Okay.
So there are people that have a history in Hollywood. So I kind of wanted to get actors that, you know, it's a tough business. And so people that have survived and been through it. And anyone that's been in this business as long as, for example, Valerie and George Hamilton,
mm-hmm.
they've been through it, man. 40 years, 30 years in this business.
They've
survived.
Yeah.
And they're still open and they're willing to show up for this little tiny movie.
Yep.
And for a director they don't really know.
Right.
And it's pretty amazing.
Blessed. You're being blessed. You got the blessings from the Godfather. You know what I mean?
Yes.
You basically have Fred Roos, Fred Roos calls any casting director, any agent, because since, you know, he's old school, you know, Francis Ford Coppola, Godfather 1 and 2 3.
At one point, he will call upon you for a favor.
No. I'm just saying. I wanted to get to this. So, and you had a phone call with Lily Tomlin. I want you to play the phone call. You have the voicemail. This is Lily Tomlin. Fucking Lily Tomlin. I'm going to big you the fuck up. Lily Tomlin.
Big up.
You know who Lily Tomlin is. Everybody knows. Lily Tomlin is a fucking phenomenal comedian, amazing artist, actor. She's an amazing actor and a huge, huge human being. Okay? So Rosemary gets the script to Lily Tomlin. And of course, Fred Roos's name helps and all this other stuff. Do you have it on?
I gotta see if I have it.
Okay. So gets the name and gets the script to her.
I can give you this plug.
You can plug this in if you want and just play it right in there. Yeah, just.
So is Lily gonna be in this or
no,
we're not
no,
sure?
No, listen to this.
No, Lily's schedule is booked.
Yeah, I see.
But it's pretty amazing.
It might be a little loud, but we'll figure it out.
She's a gracious, amazing woman that took the time to read it in a really short time.
Play it. Bam, 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 bam.
Mary, it's Lily. You might have to take it out of the case.
Oh, I do?
Yeah, because the case is stopping the...
Take it out of the case.
Okay, hold on.
Yeah, she's fucking iPhones.
Take it out the case, Rick. Take it out the case. Take it out the case, Rick.
Take it out the case, Rick.
Take it out the case,
Rick.
Take it out the case.
Here we go. Ready?
All right.
Rosemary, it's Lily.
you know, I didn't call yesterday because I was busy all day. And then, I mean, in meetings, I tried to. But I finally was able to read the script this morning, finish it. And the script is so so sweet and warm and funny and moving, too. So, but, you know, I sent you that schedule, and I'm sorry it's taking me this long. I would love to work with you, and I hear some good things about you from other people. I just feel like I can't take it on with everything that I have going on at the moment. And I have a big October as well, so I need this time to get ready for that, Rosemary. I'm so sorry. I hope you have someone in mind that you've got already and you're not stretched down to the wire. I really apologize. I just don't think I can do it. I'll be looking forward to seeing it, that's for sure, because it's really charming and rich. Anyway, bless you. Hope it all goes well. Bye-bye.
Let me get that plug.
I just think that was really classy and really generous, and it says a lot about who Lily Tomlin is.
That's just The Price is Wrong. I had to play that because it's a downer, because I heard the message and I'm thinking, is she gonna say yeah? And then she says all that stuff when you play it, and she goes, I'm really sorry. But you know what? Lily Tomlin is a classy human being. Okay, not a classy woman. She's a classy human being. You know, you read about people who, especially they say Hollywood this, Hollywood that. I mean, a lot of people took the time to meet with Rosemary, especially Jacqueline Bisset. I mean, if you don't know who Jacqueline Bisset is, Google Jacqueline, class act. She had Rosemary over on Saturday. They had a 2-hour-long conversation. She honestly...
People have various reasons why they're not going to... You know,
no.
Schedule not permitting, and this is all happening last minute. What happened is we're going to be shooting at the Horace Hyde Estates.
Horace Hyde Estates. Hold on a second.
Big up to Kay Butterfield.
Big the fuck up to Horace Hyde Estates, man. You big band playing motherfucker. Big up.
You big up. Glad.
Big up to Kay Butterfield. What's up, mommy? What's up, baby? That's my girl right there, Kay. Kay's a sweetheart. Big
so we
band.
Had to wait to get the location before we could really start getting it out to actors. So everything's happened very fast, and all the actors, you know, we're trying to get people in their 70s. And
well, you know, it's such a telling, you know, of how great the movie's going to be that all these people are, you know, giving it their blessing, because you know there's so many movies nowadays that are just sound effects, car crashes,
right,
guys on steroids,
right,
you know,
cum shots.
To have a film, to have something that actually, you know,
has a story.
Thank you, you
with
know?
Real
yeah.
people.
There's just not enough of that. And, you know, the theme of the show today is female directors. And I think that as we can start to greenlight more female directors and give more female directors the chance to take the ball and run with it, we're going to get more real life story movies versus just, you know,
cum shots.
You know, yeah, spaceships crashing. I mean, how many fucking, like, the world is going to end movies do we need?
Yeah.
I mean, there's...
End the world already if it's going to fucking end.
Well,
don't tease us with it.
I'm happy to direct one of those movies, though, having said that.
What?
We just don't get that much opportunity to direct those movies.
Right.
But if they hired us, I'd be happy to direct one of those movies.
No, I understand.
Yeah, but then when they try to interject like a love scene in the end of the world movie, it'll actually be something, because they try and throw these like just loose, thin, like, you know, they're trying to make it everything. And it's just like, just make it an end of the world movie. Nobody loves anybody when the world is ending. They're all like climbing on top of each other.
Well, it's very interesting that you said, green light. And then interesting that you said, Rosemary, that you would be happy to direct Kumquat Part 3 in 3D.
Yeah, the zombies attack Predator versus Aliens.
Yeah, yeah.
Terminator 17,000.
Yeah, assholes and chitlins in space. Part 3.
Transformers 97.
In fucking Vibrationton. Yeah. 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 Vibrationton. Yeah, your seat will fucking... Anyway, so yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because, I mean, I studied acting. I studied 2.5 years of Meisner technique in New York City. I've done stand-up comedy. I've auditioned for TV shows, comedies, episodics, a lot of commercials. God knows I've auditioned for a lot of fucking commercials, right? I've been lucky enough.
This is Nestor in acting school. Every week. week.
Let me finish.
He would be protesting. He would be protesting something. So every week, that was his core, was like injustice
anger.
And protesting.
Anger was my core.
Anger. So every week, he'd be putting something on his face or gathering some props together. I'd be like, what are you doing this week? I don't know. I'm going to go in and I'm going to tell him. So he was always protesting.
Well, before you go into protesting.
That was awesome.
As an actor, you're trained. And one of the things you have to learn is what your thermatic cord is. What's the thing that really sets you off? Once you know that as an actor, then you know what characters you can play, what characters and what circumstances you can play more easily.
What was your core?
Well, my thermatic cord was injustice. That was pretty much it. That's the thing that'll get me fucking going in 2 or 3 seconds. I mean,
zero. And now you're taking it to the people on the story is public radio.
Yeah. Right.
On your .com dial.
Yeah. To the people.
From everywhere. Gather around. Checking out the sound.
People. Right. So that was my thermatic cord. And one of the things that you had to do when you're studying Meisner is that you have to have an activity that you're doing. This is in the beginning of Meisner. We're going to go all over the place here. But you have an activity that you're doing, and then somebody comes to the door. It's called the door exercise. Somebody knocks on the door, and what the exercise is designed to do is so that if you really listen and you really respond to the other actor, then the scene will organically escalate, and eventually you'll be thrown off your guard and something will happen. It's teaching you how to create, you know, organically create behavior, right? Sanford Meisner's definition of acting was living truthfully under imaginary circumstances.
So in Silver Skies, Nestor's going to play a part of a racetrack manager.
A racist.
There's a Hollywood racetrack because the story's about an apartment complex that's being turned into condominiums, and it's largely about working class people, real people. One of the characters that Jack McGee plays, he still works at the racetrack. Mm-hmm. Like my dad worked at the racetrack selling programs.
Right.
And so that's what Nick does.
So horse racing?
Yes, horse racing. Yeah. So Hollywood racetrack.
Thoroughbred horse racing.
Yes. So Hollywood racetrack is actually being torn down in December.
Hollywood racetrack.
And they're putting up condominiums. So the character that Nestor is going to be playing is a racetrack manager that goes in. They have this bathroom there because back in the day, which Hollywood racetrack was built by some of the
Hollywood
studios moguls.
Yeah.
And
I was going to get rich to Google that.
Their history is basically they had like 80,000 people every weekend. So there's a bathroom in there that I have a picture of that literally has 50 urinals in it.
50 urinals? 50. So that's a lot of pee.
My goal, if they'll work with me, is to get a scene in there where Jack is in there. And part of the deal at the racetrack when my dad worked there is that they weren't allowed. It was all old guys selling the programs, but they weren't allowed to go to the bathroom. So they have to stand there. So if you got them out, some of them literally peed like behind the booth.
Right.
And some of them.
These are older dudes, man.
When they walked around, and they were
disgusting.
Getting paid like
it's
nothing.
It's fucked up. It's fucked up.
They were
disgusting.
Getting abused.
This is true, and you know they get paid fucking below minimum wage. This is true. My father-in-law sold programs, racing fucking programs.
Where, in L.A.?
No, in Florida. There were two tracks. One track, Gulfstream played, had races between January and let's say June, and then there's
it was Calder Hialeah. So Jack is a character that's in the bathroom. He's relieving the other guys, and then he comes to the bathroom himself, and the manager, played by Nestor, comes in and fires him and tells him, you can't look out for those other guys. You're breaking the rules too many times. You got to get out. So again, the core of injustice like comes, and so I think Nestor's gonna knock out that scene.
You're a fucking loser. You shouldn't be pissing in the fucking sink, you fucking.
I remember one time, dude, I took this job at this hotel in Seattle, and I came, it was my first and only day, and I found out we can't take a leak in the bathrooms, we have to go across to the Starbucks. I was like, I'm leaving.
I worked in construction in New York as an electrician, and I don't know if you guys know, they don't have bathrooms in new fucking buildings when they're going up on the ground, right?
Sure.
It's just concrete slabs and stuff like that. So they basically build these shanties with latrines in them, and it's the most disgusting, vile fucking place anybody could ever go to urinate or defecate, okay? Sorry to say that. On top of that, there's racial epithets, fucking swastikas, all sorts of shit. So not only do I gotta sit in a fucking 12-inch by 12-inch cubicle that smells like rhinoceros ass, I gotta fucking read and look at swastikas. And you know, I used to say, you know what? Fuck that. I'm going, they usually, I worked in Midtown and I go to a hotel and I used to wear coveralls. So underneath, when I took my coveralls, I'd look normal, not like these fucking bums that would work there. They'd go to work in jeans or whatever, get all dirty and get on the train looking like, you know, they went through a fucking dust blizzard. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'd have coveralls and I'd just take my fucking coveralls off and I'd walk out, go into a hotel and use the bathroom like a fucking human being and then come back and put my coveralls on. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And many times I'd get in trouble. They'd be like, where'd you go? I went to shit like a fucking real person in a real toilet bowl. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This is shit. It's
okay to put swastikas all over a bathroom because he showed me pictures of it.
I got pictures of this shit.
There's swastikas all over the bathroom on the construction site. Yeah. But if he goes across the street to a decent bathroom, he gets shit.
Yeah, I went to shit like a free American.
Not for nothing, but I refuse. I mean, you know,
I'm going to make a movie about that someday.
Yeah,
the construction industry.
I'm not uptight about race and stuff like that. But when you start putting fucking certain things on the wall, you know, I'm not dealing with it. Anyway, back.
You should read this scene.
To Silver Skies. We're going to read this scene right now?
You
want to
read
the
scene? Yeah.
Whoa. Hold on a second. Right. Let's not get too crazy with the scene.
Where was the inspiration for the movie? That's
what
I want to know.
Thank you.
That's a good question. The inspiration is because I grew up, my parents adopted me and they were always older. So I'm pretty old. So back in the day, when I was adopted.
You're pretty old?
When I was adopted, my mother had me adopted me when she was 42. But now that's common. Like the last 10 years or so, that's common. Back then it wasn't. So I kind of grew up feeling
Did
like
you
I
say
had
common?
Grandparents.
Peace, this is Common. And right now you're checking out Nestorius Public Radio. Y'all stay in tune. Love.
That's right.
Yeah, I have a Common wannabe in my movie because Common passed.
Well, let's go back.
But I love Common.
I love Common. But we're going to go real back. He's asking you about that.
So I think it's because I've always had an affinity for older people.
Right.
Because I always have an affinity, like Nestor, regarding injustice. I always have an affinity or a desire to tell for the underdog.
Well, you know, like kids nowadays, you know, we're in this such a new, what's new that nobody, you know, seems to care about, A, elderly people, and also, you know, some of the people that we wanted to get to later on in the show, some of the early female directors, kids nowadays don't know that.
Nobody knows that. Fucking kids nowadays don't know that. Motherfuckers don't even know what the Holocaust was. What are you talking about? Filmmakers. They don't even know what fucking...
People don't even know who Big Daddy Kane is.
People don't even know what Snoop Dogg is. People don't even know who Run DMC
that's 'cause
he's
Snoop Lion now.
You know what I mean? Shit. Yo, but you Googled Hollywood Racetrack. Could you tell me, like, give me a summary of who started, who put it together? I believe it was a couple of Hollywood studio heads because they had some beef with Santa Anita Racetrack and they couldn't do something there. And they said, fuck you, we're going to build our own. Right? Something like that?
Yeah, well, let's see here. The track was opened in 1938 by the Hollywood Turf Club. The racetrack was designed by noted racetrack architect Arthur Froelich.
So it's a fucking historical a building, okay?
Its chairman was Harry Warner of Warner Brothers.
Warner Brothers, that's
and
right.
And its 600 shareholders included Hollywood luminaries, including another brother brand, Jack Warner, Harry Warner, Al Jolson, Raoul Walsh, were members of the founding board of directors.
Fatty Arbuckle, Charlie Chaplin, Errol Flynn.
Mervyn
you know what
LeRoy
I mean?
Was a director from 1941 to 87. Hollywood Park closed from 42 to 44 due to World War II.
Yeah.
Right.
Where it was used as a storage facility.
Right.
In 49, the grandstand and the clubhouse were destroyed by a fire. The rebuilt facility reopened in 1950. In 1984, the racetrack was extended from 1 mile to around 1 1/8 mile.
Right. That's so the horses can urinate right before they finish the finish line.
Just not the program, guys. The horse is okay.
Right,
horse
let's go back to the paddock and get up. Go ahead.
That was around prior to the Breeders' Cup race in 1986. The turf course was similarly expanded to just over 7/8 of a mile around to a mile around. A card club casino was added to the complex in 94. So they have like a poker club.
Right,
poker.
Right. It's a casino.
It's a separate building.
Right. Yeah.
And that's staying, though, by the way, right?
That's staying. Well, what happens to the racetracks in this country is a lot of them, in order to survive, have put slot machines.
Right.
And so at Hollywood, they said, oh, instead of putting slot machines in the track, they actually built a separate building of a casino. So it didn't help those
tracks. Right, let's get drunken Chinese motherfuckers and give them free whiskey and let them get all fucked up and play cards.
Well, I like, now they're going to put housing right next.
Yes.
They're
building condos.
Right next to a casino. So can,
that's right.
Well, that's right. Let me, we're talking historical,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so historical, Churchill Downs bought the facility for $140 million in 1999. The previous owners of the track renamed their company Pinnacle Entertainment to concentrate on its gambling.
Oh, wow. Instance. I didn't even know that. But hold on. Is there something in there that alludes to why those Hollywood heavies decided to build their own track? Because there was a reason. And it had to do with some sort of a beef or a strife with Santa Anita Racetrack.
I think there was a track closer to the ocean, and then I think they wanted a track closer to the studio. Like, there's...
Okay.
It was also for their convenience,
okay.
I think.
Okay. All right. But here's the other thing a lot of people don't know. At the turn of the century, the radio wasn't invented. The television wasn't invented. Racing was primarily the biggest entertainment a factor in society, besides fucking in public. But horse raising was a big event. It was a big event. So... As you know, the advent of radio, television, and you know, porno came on, less and less people went to the racetrack, except riffraff, and then they started going to the racetrack, and it became a non-social event and more of a fucking gambling thing and urinal situation.
Yeah. back in the day, you had all afternoon to kill on something social.
Right,
you know,
right.
Nowadays,
right.
People want quick, you know?
Right.
But I think, personally, one of the problems why baseball's suffering. Baseball is over 100 years old. And
right.
You had time to sit there and watch pitch.
Swing. And he misses.
Pitch.
Yeah.
Nowadays, people want quick, fast action.
Right.
NBA, NFL, and,
Yeah. Right, right.
It was a different time.
I think it's a different time.
I was joking around, but I'm just trying to give you a historical context of where racing played in our time. It was an event. It was something that people did.
You got dressed up. At the Kentucky Derby.
That's one of the few traditions America has.
Yeah. Yeah, if you had money riding on it, you did it. You were there, it was real time. Now, I got a friend, huge gambler, and he's on his iPhone.
Right.
He doesn't even watch the games.
Right.
He's constantly looking at
numbers
to see what the numbers are, and it refreshes every 5 seconds. And he's like, no! Oh!
Right.
There's a
character that I wanted to play in Silver Skies, which is this two guys at the racetrack yelling at the screen. One of my favorite things, I enjoy going to the racetrack on occasion. I just enjoy it. It's one of those things I don't like sports at all. I don't like baseball.
But you enjoy yelling.
Well, yeah, but I enjoy the nostalgic factor of a racetrack and of a baseball field. You can go to any baseball field in America, and once you enter the baseball field and you look at the open sky, it could be 1953. It could be, you know what I'm saying? It's an amazing phenomenon. And the racetrack kind of does the same thing, and it depends on the racetrack. But I do enjoy yelling, and I do enjoy the intense, intoxicating yelling and getting in the moment of seeing your horse getting so fucking close. Come on, bitch! You fucking whore! Come on, you fucking whore! Come on! And then it becomes a frenzy and everybody's doing it. Number seven! Come on, seven! Lucky seven! And everyone's going...
The band is You Fucking Whore. You Fucking Whore is being passed by White Lightning.
Yeah, yeah. And it becomes this frenzy and it's such an amazing... thrill. I mean, it's I enjoy that. Here's another thing I enjoy along the lines of that, which going back to baseball, I enjoy sitting in the bleachers where all the fucking degenerates sit out. And I enjoy more than the game, I enjoy the socio-psychological interaction between, you know, the Yankees and the Boston Red Sox and the fans. The fans.
I love heckling. I'm
the
such
fucking
a good heckler.
Fans. So to me, that's very interesting. Anyway, back to the movies. So, Silver Skies, you want to read a scene? Let's read a scene. And then I would like to spend a little time discussing. Well, did you finish your thought on where the idea for Silver Skies came from? I mean, it was basically you.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just about beautiful things, about valuable things and people. That but how just did, tossed aside.
But how did you and
as
Pat
invaluable?
How did you and Pat decide to like let's start writing this? How did that come up?
Well, I think I was just getting to a personal place of you know where my parents were always older, and I was always the kid that like I wanted to play cards with the adults. Like I always wanted to hang out with the adults because I always thought the adults were way more interesting than the people my age.
Right.
And I still feel that way even as I get older. I still am attracted to like older people right. to like be a sponge around them.
Yeah.
And to learn, because right. I feel like life is very hard, and I want to learn and know how they've done it.
I grew up two houses down from a Jewish retirement home.
Harvey!
Wow.
Harvey! Could you get some of that meatloaf out yeah. of your teeth? Harvey!
So I used to go there all the time. I mean, we would go there for all sorts of reasons. We would go there just to get cranberry juice from the dispensary.
For free.
Yeah, we would go there as kids.
The little cans, right? The 8-ounce cans.
We had no cable. I would go in and hang as a kid and watch, like, the Seahawks on television. We right. didn't have a TV, you know? So I grew up with that and, you know, going and hanging with a lot of the elderly there. And I'm here to tell you right now, some of these old Jewish women
fuck
in
yeah.
the retirement home are funnier than 50% of the stand-up comedians I've ever
hell
seen in my
yeah.
life.
Hell
they're
yeah.
They're hilarious.
Yeah. I mean, seriously, women. You want to learn?
50% of stand-up comics I've ever performed with can't touch these old women.
No.
They're
no.
hilarious.
But, I mean, you want to learn wisdom? You go into any older, like, nursing home, be it Jewish, be it a black nurse home, there's something about a person who has lived a long, mm-hmm. full life. Mm-hmm. There's wisdom in their eyes. There's wisdom in their smile. Do you know what I mean? They're not fighting anything anymore, unless you're Puerto Rican, of course. But you're not yeah. fighting anything. You're like, you're gliding at that point in your life. You know what I mean?
My mother wasn't gliding. She was a fighter till the
no, but
the
your
second
mother,
she died.
There are exceptions, but your mother was something, boy. Your mother was a fighter. You're right. Your mother was a fighter.
I'm just saying there's all kinds of people. You get to the end, you know, at the end of your life, it's
yeah,
like what I have in this is six characters that are all, you know, some in the late 60s, some in their 70s, some even 80s, where everyone's different because they've made different decisions.
Different choices in their life.
How to live. And so you get to the end of your life and you got to face the truth about what decisions you made, who you are, and it's going to come back to you.
So and accept it. You got to accept
it yeah. or just deal with it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. I meant to say, you know, when I grow older, I want to be, you know, wise and not fight anymore and just glide. That's
God,
what I mean.
I hope
not,
so.
Not everybody.
I'm exhausted.
Not everybody loves house music.
I can see you up there. What? I don't want green Jell-O. I want red Jell-O. This is an injustice, red Jell-O.
I'd be like, this stupid motherfucker.
Fuck that. I didn't ask for green Jell-O, you fucking whore.
You could be broadcasting from your room. Like, God damn it, they're folding my laundry wrong.
Actually, you know what's interesting about people who are older and have Alzheimer's is that what I've noticed is that, like, usually, if you are an asshole, mean, fuck, or miserable, when you have Alzheimer's, that person will now become happy, joy. Like, they switch for some reason. So, you guys have hope, because I've been a miserable fuck for a good portion of my life. A cocksucker, motherfucker, you know, fighting, arguing about stupid shit. You know, negative
injustice in the world.
Negative, judgmental.
Seeing injustice where it doesn't need to be seen.
Always looking for injustice,
cab drivers.
Even though there's fucking rainbows. You guys
exactly.
have hope.
Seeing injustice when looking at a rainbow.
Oh, yeah. Rainbow's there. I'm like, yeah, but the red is fuzzy. Yeah. The fucking red is fuzzy on there. So basically, you guys have hope that I will get Alzheimer's and be just happy, joyous, and free on the second part of my life.
Yes. You know? Sit there chewing applesauce, loving life.
Going, this is good.
Well, you know, they say most of your unhappiness comes from the past.
Of course. Thinking of the past,
thinking of the future. So if all you have is, you know, if you can't remember the past, what's to be upset about?
And that's happening already. I can't remember shit in the past. You know, isn't that funny how you remember like things like from like 19 fucking 60 something, but you can't remember shit from yesterday? Yeah. That's crazy. That's crazy.
Oh, that's crazy.
So you wanted us to read a scene.
No, you don't have to.
I want to read it. So set up the scene. Let me know.
All right. So Phil is this guy who was a gopher for Dean Martin. So he kind of got all the ladies that were like the Dean Martin throw offs and stuff, which were still pretty hot babes. And so he considers himself, you know, kind of like a gigolo, and he has Alzheimer's, and he goes in and out of thinking he's Dean Martin at times. So he's played by George Hamilton. And Mickey is a guy who's sort of been married for 46 years, and he's pretty beat down by his wife all the time.
Right.
So the two of them are at this golf course, which is on Horse Hyde Estates.
Who's playing Mickey? Do we know?
Not yet.
Okay.
This shit is like to the wire, dude. We start shooting on Monday, and we don't have the whole fucking movie cast. It's crazy.
So this is just a really quick little... I know, it's crazy.
It's crazy.
This is just a quick little scene. Rich will read Mickey, and Nestor will read Phil, and I'll just read the stage directions.
You're going to read the stage directions.
Exterior golf course day. Parched. Phil and Mickey get ready to tee off at the first hole.
Kevin passes by, sees them. Oh, okay. Never mind that.
I beat her on the drives, but she licked me on the putts.
Even I can remember you told me that joke 20 times.
Mickey removes some meds from his pill case.
Give me a swig.
Phil gives him the bottle. Mickey pops the pills and washes them down. He makes a face.
Ugh.
It's my holy water.
I take all kinds of shit to take a shit, but it doesn't help.
Then don't take so much shit.
Who the fuck knows? What I wouldn't give to be regular.
Mickey's about to take a swing.
At least you don't have to wear diapers.
You're wearing diapers?
No, but I'll be incontinent one day.
Yeah, but incontinent can make you sound dashing.
It does?
Yeah, like you're a jet setter, a world traveler, going from country to country, continent to continent. So when someone asks me, how's Phil? I can say, oh, he's incontinent. And they'll say, when he comes back to the continent, let me know.
Yeah. Makes wearing Pampers sound romantic.
They look at each other. Who are they kidding? So that's it.
Nice.
That's just a quick listening. Alan Mandel, who wrote Smokey and the Bandit. He's been helping me.
He punched up the script a little bit.
Punched the dialogue, and he's been amazing person to be around.
So you're basically, I mean, the purpose of this Big up Alan Mandel, you fucking bomba clod. No, Alan's a sweet man, and he went above and beyond. But so basically, this was just like a little slice of the movie. Just two guys that, you know, one's this and the other guy's that, and they're having a normal day.
Well, they all have to figure out how to get the money to stay where they are. They either go because they want to stay. They got to move. They got to stay. They just don't know what they're going to do. So, you know, I think it goes to trying to tell stories that have some meaning, that have value to life, that reflect real life. There's a movie that is sort of my inspiration is this movie Going in Style, which was with George Burns and Art Carney and Lee Strasberg, about three guys who every morning they sit on a bench in Queens and their life is boring. And they're like, you know what? Let's go rob a bank. Because if we end up in jail, what the fuck is the difference?
Right, right.
You know, so that's sort of it's reality. Right. It's like Robert Altman style. It's like reality and what people go through. And, you know, I think being what you touched upon earlier about the studio films and all that, you know, it's interesting to think about. I think of myself as a director, not a female director. But at the same time, the history of female filmmakers is one of telling socially relevant films and sort of pioneering like risky subjects and push the envelope as far as truth and what they're going to make films about and stuff. So,
Think of how many cultures throughout human history where the women were the storytellers in villages, mm-hmm. around fires, tucking children in at bed, you know. Yeah.
My mother, was a storyteller. You want a story? Come over here. She'd take out her fucking shoe and hit me in the head. That was the story,
my
right
mom,
there.
You want a story? Wash the dishes.
Yeah, you want a story? Come here. You what flavor of a story you want? Come here. And she'd give me a whack in the fucking head, and you know, I'd hear the end credits, the music.
Well, I think what a lot of people don't know is there's a couple women that were some of the pioneers of Hollywood.
Right, right,
such
right.
Such as Lois Weber
and Alice Guy Blaine. Lache, yeah.
So,
which were the forerunners and the pioneers of the narrative film? Because prior to these women, black and whites were just shorts of little stupid things that people did. They really didn't have like a beginning, middle, and an end. They didn't really have a story, an arc. And so you bring these women in, Alice Guy Blaché, for instance, and she, you know, grows from being a secretary at a photo shop to eventually running a film company to starting her own fucking film company, Solax.
She was the only woman to ever manage and own her own studio. And still, to this day, the only woman.
The only woman.
The Solax company. And she directed over 1,000 films.
Which, by the way, Solax, I never knew Alice Guy Blaché had anything to do with Solax. But you remember us watching movies on AMC back then. They used to show movies, or TCM, and some of those old black and white movies, you'd see the Solax logo. Mm. And I didn't even know what the fuck Solax was. You know what I mean?
That was her own studio.
Cool, yeah.
You know what's amazing is she did that in, what, 24 years?
Mm-hmm.
She did that.
What do you mean in 24 years?
Like her career was 24 years.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's the span of her career, right.
Yeah,
right.
That's
and
it.
22 of those films, of the 1,000 films, were features. So in 24 years, she made 22 features, mm-hmm. as right. well as, you know,
right.
however many left thousands of, it's ridiculous.
Right, right. Basically, you gotta really Google
very
this
prolific.
Woman. Alice Guy, spelled G-U-I, as in like guy, dash Blaché, B-L-A-C-H-E. So Alice Guy Blaché, she's was a French woman who worked for Leon Gaumont, she was a secretary at his still photography company. And then Leon Gaumont decided to start his own film company, the Gaumont Film Company. And she evolved from that to starting to do her own movies. And when I say narrative, she used to write scripts. She was a writer and would do. Am I wrong, or am I?
No, I think she was a writer, but mostly known as a director.
No. I know that a director, but I'm saying she wrote.
Yeah.
The film. She just didn't just direct like a fly landing on somebody's nose or whatever the hell it was.
Well, what's kind of sad is that she ended up, her husband ended up leaving her. They were in New Jersey, and her husband ended up leaving her for an actress and went out to Hollywood.
Right.
And she ended up, I think she returned to France eventually, but she was bankrupt and got divorced, and she never was able to make another film again. She lost her studio after getting divorced.
Right.
And she lost everything, and she never got to make another film again.
Yeah.
And
well, back
most
in the,
of her films were destroyed.
Yeah. Well, back in the day, so many women had to, you know, hide behind their husbands if they wanted mm-hmm. to do anything. They mm-hmm. couldn't be out there doing stuff without a husband
you,
and a
you,
single
you were
woman.
Nothing.
That's right. Yeah.
Without your husband, which, yeah. think about the irony of that.
The
know?
Same thing happened to Lois Weber. I mean, she was the brains behind the operation, but, it, you know, her husband got a lot of the credit.
Well, Lois Weber was an American silent film actress, screenwriter, producer, and director. She started as a silent film actress and is one of those notable women directors that you know, made fucking the Hollywood film industry, you know, be what it is, you know, today.
Yeah, there have been a lot of women that have re-revolutionized it and not really got the credit. One of the things, you know, I think it's very, very important for young women in high school, young women in middle school, to know who these pioneer women were, mm-hmm. because it hasn't been that long in history. You know, Lois Weber got lambasted for doing a show about birth control. Well, in 1912 at the time, anybody talking or promoting birth control, you could go to jail.
Right.
The Supreme Court at this country ruled that birth control and talking about birth control was illegal.
Just talking about
it. So a man could, you know, could have sex and leave.
Right.
But a woman couldn't.
It was illegal because a woman, it was a woman, right? Because if it was a man who had to have fucking birth control or whatever, it'd be a different story.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was the woman that bore the brunt of anything that could happen, and you know,
so
but here we are, even in today's day and age, where people in our society are trying to go backwards with women's issues mm-hmm. and abortion issues and
yeah.
all these things.
Oh yeah, go backwards.
But women need to know who these people were. Who were the women's suffrage movement? Who was you know, right. you know, a lot of these early
women
feminist
have been
pioneers
wiped out of history, largely wiped out of history.
Wiped out.
There's a museum. Many years ago, we went to D.C. and there's. Of course, I'm not going to remember exactly the name of it, but it's the National Museum of the
Women's Arts or something like that.
Yeah, I have to look it up right now.
It's all right. Just
but
tell the artist.
It's a museum that you walk into in D.C. and it's the entire museum is women artists.
Women artists.
Because uh-huh. you go to the Met, you go to and there's hardly any women.
Right. Predominantly men
there at all. As right. if yeah. there were no women that painted.
Right.
Ever.
But
or
there was
sculptures.
one particular woman artist who was so prolific and amazing. But she gave up her career so her husband, who was also a prolific and amazing artist in his own right, so that he can have a career. But it turns out she was, I don't know her name, so you're going to have to help me out with this, hon. But it turns out she was so much better of an artist than he was. I mean, really, not just an opinion. And, of course, her shit gets, you know, washed and pushed aside and all that stuff.
Let me go. Was, even the Marion Doherty.
The documentary, there's a documentary on HBO.
Called Casting By. Everybody should watch
this Casting By. You have
you need to
watch
check this out.
You have to watch this documentary. Casting By, Marion Doherty, the late, great Marion Doherty. Who,
casting director.
Who we
discovered
met. She discovered fucking Dustin
Redford,
Hoffman,
Robert
Redford, Al Pacino, all these fucking people.
Yeah.
She directed movies based
Meryl
on. Meryl Streep, real, not glamorous looking actors and all that stuff, but real people looking actors, like yeah. real nitty gritty fucking actors
yeah.
and auditioned them and put them, you know, Midnight Cowboy and on and on and on and on.
Yeah, because before that, you know, they looked for stars,
right.
big busty blonde women,
right.
big guys with big jaws and,
big
you know,
cheeks.
You know, and
they
tall,
don't do
strong
that anymore,
guys.
Do they?
Well,
no.
now, well, yeah, but I'm
yeah,
saying
know,
is,
right?
but what she did was, she says, okay, you know, maybe Dustin Hoffman is short, but this guy can act.
And he's interesting.
Well, yeah. she was on the East Coast. She was in New York. And so
right.
she really had a sense of New York theater and New York theater
right.
actors.
Theater
putting
actors.
Them into film.
Real
and, like,
actors.
Honoring that. But she, you know, it took her, like, casting directors were not considered, they didn't get credit. And right. then at some point they started getting credit. And Lynn Stalmaster was a casting director in the West Coast who started being very infamous too for discovering people and doing a lot of movies. And it took him three. He had a single card credit casting by, and it took Marion Doherty, even though she had been doing longer than him and started all these people. It took her three more years before anyone would give her a single card credit. And on Midnight Cowboy, in that documentary,
right.
the producer of Midnight Cowboy would not give her
Fought.
Her own credit.
Fought.
And she asked him, and he and in the documentary he says, for 45 years I've regretted not giving that to her.
That yeah. movie, Midnight Cowboy, would not. By the way, John, what's his name?
John Voight.
John Voight, Angelina Jolie's fucking dad, okay? But Midnight Cowboy, I'm walking here! If you don't know where that line came from, that's the movie.
Marion cast that movie.
And the reason that movie is the fucking movie it is mm-hmm. because of John Voight and Dustin Hoffman.
And they also, at the end of that, in the documentary, they talk about doing a campaign for trying to get her an honorary Oscar. Yeah.
An Oscar.
De Niro wrote a letter.
Work.
Meryl Streep wrote
Everybody.
A letter.
Everybody.
And
work.
No one would give her an Oscar
no.
because
no.
it's such a male-dominated.
That's,
and,
right.
And,
That's right.
And they were mad. And this shows how stupid some people can be. They were mad that they about the word casting director.
Right.
Because I'm the director.
Right.
Well, I think very
a
few
casting director
really...
isn't a director. That was the argument.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, right. It's ridiculous. Anyway, that museum is called the National Museum of Women in the Arts.
Right, right. And what was the name of the artist? You know who she is because that's your homegirl.
I think you're talking about Camille Claudel.
Camille Claudel, thank you.
Well, I feel in so many ways women's rights are going backwards. In some ways they're going forwards, in a lot of ways they're going backwards. I mean, you know, society's becoming more misogynistic in a lot of ways.
Let me
music and film and theater.
Well, it's getting back to materialism and you know, just surface shit. It's less.
So many women went out back in the day to champion for things that nowadays we take for granted. I guess that's my point.
I just want to say this really quick. I don't know if you guys saw this, but there's a documentary being made by about Alice.
Yes, there is.
Alice Guy Blaget. Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
And, I mean, long fucking overdue.
Well, go to Kickstarter and
really
and check out the trailer. I watched it and it's amazing. Ben Kingsley is like, I don't know who she was. Really, like people that you know you would think and nobody knows. And it's not their fault. It's just not.
Is there Gary Dantelli, is he associated with that?
Let me see.
Well, while you're looking for that,
I'll look because
while you're looking for that, let me just tell you this. So, just to give you a little snippet of what women, pioneering women, or just women in general, but Alice Guy Blaget, you said she made 24 films or 22 films in 24 years.
No, features. She made a thousand films.
A thousand films, but 22 features.
24 years, 22 features.
Got it. And features meaning. A 60-minute, 90-minute, over 60-minute fucking film. That's a serious beginning, middle, and end. And she also, didn't she pioneer the split screen, or was that Lois?
That was Lois.
I mean, these are fucking amazing things that no one ever did back then because it didn't exist. Mm-hmm. It's not like no one ever did because they didn't want to do them. This shit didn't exist. They invented this stuff.
They were both first to use sound.
Yeah, we also should say that once they really became popular and the movie started making money,
that's when men moved out to Hollywood.
That's when the guys took over and kicked the women out. I mean, that's really what happened.
That's when the men came from New York, Wall Street.
Money to be made. The men are going to make it.
Here's something. Luella Parsons said this. I guess there's a quote. Paramount is proud of its only woman director, Dorothy Arzner. In fact, the whole film industry is proud of Miss Arzner, who, with Lois Weber, is the only woman to achieve fame as a director. Years ago, of course, there was Madame Blaché, but we haven't heard of her in a number of years.
Look, it took how long before Catherine Bigelow won an Academy Award, the first woman to win?
Well,
About the Iraq War,
Hurt
right?
Locker.
Yeah.
Let me read this about Guy Blaget, okay? So you know she directed all those movies. She directed her last film in 1920, she lost her studio. Her film studio was went bankrupt, as you explained, after she got divorced and all that stuff. And she went to France. But in 1922. But in 1927, Guy returned to the United States in an attempt to retrieve some of her old work, but was unsuccessful. Now in 1930, Leon Gaumont published the history of his company. That's the dude that did the Gaumont Film Company, who basically she started. She became the head of that company, that studio company, before she came up with Solax. But Gaumont published the history of his company with no mention of any production history before 1907. This upset Guy, prompting her to write a letter to Gaumont, after which he agreed to change the documents. However, these changes were never published. The rest of Guy's career and life was dedicated to her children. So basically, after she got fucked. Yeah. The motherfucker doesn't even put her in the history of the company. You know what I mean? This is the type of shit that happened. Let me read something to you about Lois Weber. A film historian, Anthony Slide, asserts that along with D.W. Griffith, Lois Weber was the American cinema's first genuine auteur, a filmmaker involved in all aspects of production and one who utilized the motion picture to put across her own ideas and philosophies. Anyway, so these are two women that if, you know, you want to learn something about the true evolution of filmmaking, Hollywood studio systems, and, you know, where, you know, this fucking psychotic entertainment business came from, you might want to check those two women out. Definitely check out Mary and Doherty. I mean, you know what?
Just hire more women.
Rosemary and I met Mary and Doherty at the Rochester Film Festival back in, 2001 or some shit? High Falls Film Festival in Rochester. Mm-hmm. Rochester is such a cute little town. Rochester is the home of Xerox and Kodak. Two different fucking things. Talk about old being thrown the fuck out. Kodak going bankrupt, and you know, bam, that shit. Well, that's another story. We should do a an episode on George Eastman. George Eastman is a fucking, which is related to film. I mean, he
it's a photographer, right?
He was
created
okay.
Kodak.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Real quick. George Eastman, right? Who is the founder and originator of the Kodak Film Company, right? He wanted to, he was an entrepreneur, and at the age of 21 or something, owned that company. He developed a camera. This is at the turn of the century when film was invented, photograph film, still film photography. He came up with a consumer use camera, this way back when, where you can take pictures. The camera was already loaded. You can send the camera back to the George Eastman Kodak company. They would take the film out of the camera, develop it, send you pictures, and a camera with film again so you to use it. This fucking dude was a genius. Here's another thing. He named his company Kodak because he wanted his company to be pronounceable in any language in any country and spelled the same way. So if you go to Japan, Kodak is Kodak. If you go to Russia, Kodak is Kodak. And it's basically the beginning of image placement, like McDonald's, product identification. The dude was a fucking genius, and he was a gazillionaire at the age of 20-something. All
and
this.
Now Kodak is bankrupt. Last year, they stopped manufacturing film cameras.
Film cameras, yeah.
And that largely went unnoticed in the media.
Right, unnoticed in the media. Anyway, so we should do an episode on that because that dude, and it's actually related to what we just talked about, so maybe the next episode we can do a little research on that and have that discussion because without Kodak, there would be almost no motion picture film.
I think it's great that you just paid tribute to two women directors.
Yeah. So, but back to Marion Doherty. You gotta Google Marion Doherty. Definitely check out the movie, the casting movie.
Casting by.
It's HBO. On HBO Go. Marion Doherty was amazing. These women were amazing filmmakers, directors, pioneering fucking artists. Forget about acting.
Taking an hour to talk about artists in general and people that took a risk and told stories is a great use of time. So
unbelievable, yeah. And so before we wrap up, Rosemary Rodriguez, director. We didn't even talk about all the fucking TV shows you've directed. I wanted to talk about some of that stuff. You've directed Dennis Farina, fucking Anthony LaPaglia, Juliana Margulies. I mean, on and on and on and on. There's a million. Jeremy Renner. Fucking Jeremy Renner is like the Tom Cruise of our fucking time right now. Think about it. You know what I mean? Who else? I mean, you directed Jada Pinkett Smith. You've directed Dennis Quaid, Michael Chiklis. I mean, you've directed like fucking heavies on top of heavies. And these guys, you know, the one thing I'll say, and I've been on many sets, and I usually go towards the end of your job because I like you to do your own thing. I don't want to be involved and I don't be around because I'm the husband, blah, blah, blah. But I'll go in there and the first thing I am greeted with, the first thing is Rosemary's an amazing director. I'd do anything for her. I mean, she's amazing. I'm serious. This is the fucking amazing thing about it that's when I knew, because I know you beat yourself up a lot about, especially, you know, your job. You have a very stressful fucking job. I mean, you have to go into a TV show, get a script, like fucking a day before the first day of shooting. So you shooting, starting first day of production on Monday, September 23rd, it's no big fucking deal to you. You do this shit on almost every TV show. You're supposed to get
a
script.
It's a big deal. It's fun.
No. I'm saying you're supposed to get a script about fucking at least 5 days before you start shooting. You did an episode of Blue Bloods. Tom Selleck, thank you. Fucking Tom Selleck, you direct Tom Selleck, old school motherfucker. You do the show Blue Bloods, and they give you a script 8 days after the fucking show started shooting. Cocksucker motherfuckers. I'm just saying, you know, this is the type of shit. Directors get no respect in general nowadays.
Big up for the DGA.
Big up. Big up for the Directors Guild of America. Big up DGA. Yeah. Anyway, you know what? We're going to wrap the show up. I mean, we didn't spend a lot of time on. I really wanted to get into the process of being a director on TV, and I just kind of like.
We've been married 20 years. I'll be back.
No, but I'm just saying. I lightly touched on the process in the past 2 minutes, but I mean, it's a crazy fucking process from getting the script to meeting the actors for the first time to, you know, you're basically the guest chef. You know what I'm saying? Simon, you ready?
I'm always ready. Looking at my Gucci, it's about that time. We come to an end of NPR, yo.
Skittle, we bop, a D-bop, a Scooby-Doo. And guess what, America, we love you. Was it a rock and a roll? Because we got some soul, and we rock till you're 101. Get old.
Skid Row Studio, and now you know, we got to go. We'll be back next week for another show.
And remember, the 800, the 893, the 9562, OPP. That's right, y'all. So that's a wrap up. Make sure you tune into SkidRowStudios.com. Check out a bunch of shows. We got a lot of shows, right, Jeremy? Like fucking 18 shows now?
There's going to be even more. In the next month, we're adding 6 new shows.
So how many shows total do we got on Skid Row now?
I think after that 6, it's going to be somewhere around 25.
God damn.
Yo, we're growing. We're blowing up.
Booyah! Motherfuckers left Skid Row because they didn't want to deal with this shit. This shit's going to blow the fuck up. Motherfuckers are going to be on the stereo. You know what I'm saying? Hey, before we go, I want to just tap onto that fucking iTunes. Knock me out. iTunes. Jeremy sends me an email about a week ago. And the shit says, they were pissed, right? The shit says...
They didn't like your language and your descriptions.
Well, they didn't tell us. They didn't tell us what it was. They gave you like 7 different variables, right?
They're always very
vague.
Very vague about what it is that they're doing to take your feed down.
Right.
But, you know, at least they worked with us.
And
then in the end, they kind of came through and
they
said,
did.
Yo, just get rid of the fucks and the
shit. But no, they didn't say all that. You sent me like the 7 variables and I went through everything and I said, okay, it could be the logo. It could be that. And then I said, well, but aside from the logo, what it, pedophilia or racial? Nope, that doesn't think, that's not me. And but then I looked at something about, you cannot edit or censor your own, something like that. And I said, maybe I put the word fuck in there because I know I've said, you know, what a motherfucking thing or unfucking believable or whatever. And I looked and I said, oh, shit. I used the word fuck in the politician episode, which I think was episode 19 or 18.
I sent it to them with that taken out.
Right.
And then they came back and said, well, how about this shit in your description?
Oh, they did?
Yeah. I don't know if I even bothered to CC you on
that.
No,
you didn't.
Because I went through and just kind of
cleaned
up whatever they pointed out.
Yeah.
But, once it was cleaned up, then whatever.
We need to fix that A to Z, what my show's about, because what I had was stupid motherfuckers to scientific probability, so I had to take out motherfuckers.
Which is a good line, but yeah, I just took that out to get it back up.
Yeah, so I got to come up with an S, like an S comparison. Like
Simon.
You know, like, no, like fucking from syphilis
to Simon.
We'll figure it out. From syphilis to sprinkles cupcakes. Some shit like that.
Simon.
Simon's in the fucking description of one of my hosts. Simon my ass. Simon my ball sack, okay? Anyway, so SkidRowStudios.com. We got mad fucking shows. Nestorius Public Radio is back on iTunes. So I really apologize to all you people who have subscribed to the Nestorius Public Radio. If you did not get the episodes, it's up back again. It's up and running.
I'm not positive, but I think the people that were subscribed were fine. Because it was only down for what, like a day and a half? Or
yeah, but I noticed that some of the numbers were like weird from like 2 days before you sent me that thing.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was weird. It was like fucking 5 downloads? That's bizarre.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
If you're not subscribed, subscribe again.
Tell everybody.
Yeah.
Well, if you're subscribed, like Jeremy said, it doesn't matter because it's automatically in your iTunes thing. And once you log on to iTunes, whatever. Anyway, check us out on Facebook, Nestorius Public Radio. And check me out on Twitter. Not that I fucking update that shit, but Nestorius NYC. You know what I mean? And yo, have a stupid, dope, magically delicious, boombastic, illmatic week. You know what I'm saying? And big up. Big up to Rosemary Rodriguez and Silver Skies. All right.
Ooh-wee, it's me. I ain't doing nothing but talking shit. So y'all gotta, like, you know, encourage me the whole way along.